My talk would be about the role of institutions and the role of institutions in some aspects of global economic history, the area that I know most, or I've been doing research. And that's how I titled this talk, The Limits of Reciprocal Comparisons, because in general, at least in more conventional economic history, there is very little of that, despite the contribution of Gareth or Pomerantz of other people. So, see if I can run this. I'm gonna go quickly through this narrative about the financial development and as a path for growth. It's a narrative which is about scarcity, basically, and that explains how institutions favor the pooling of capital, allow the to diminish risk, to reduce uncertainty. They created all these instruments like bills of exchange, banks, insurance companies, incorporated shots, joint stocks, and so on. And I would add money of account, mean specie points, and fiduciary money. This development is associated with the international clearing of means of payment that this sort of instruments and organizations allowed. In other words, the arbitrage. And the equity finance seems to be like the link with the subsequent development of capitalism, solved the first initial outlay of capital, particularly the scale, the problems of scale of capital required for Europeans to trade. In few words, it saves specie and shorter the time for payoff, and this rendered huge efficiency gains associated with institutions more or less close to the state, but not uniquely, which provided liquidity, financial, foster financial development, and so on. This is very, very much a European narrative, or it's a narrative of European businesses, yeah? Bills were negotiated in main cities, financial markets were integrated or so, whereas the template for that parameter is Britain, that was the most centralized. And if you look at the literature, in particularly from France, this is more an exception than a rule. These differences within Europe and also across the world, they are explained by state institutions, legal systems, national features, and for Jacob Price, for instance, the capacity or the inclination to repay. And being Argentinian, I can take care of that. Nothing is said, or nothing much is said, about working capital in this development. Bills were not drawn in the colonies, neither in the British colonies, and they were paid back home only, and they were not accepted in the East Indies trade, outside the East India companies, or in the American trade. When I say American, I say Spanish American or Latin American. In the overseas trade, beyond the regulated or the company's trade in the over the Indian Ocean, that is in the Atlantic and the Pacific, the Europeans traded in both sides with silver or for silver. So I'm gonna argue or gonna base my talk on the nature and the structure and the of the Spanish overseas trade. That is, like in many other regards, the usual counterfactual for the English development of any other real. None of these instruments and institutions were present there. Yeah, even Spanish historians call these archaic institutions, traditional instruments. Yeah, this capitalism, this breed of capitalism, is identified with state-run and funded trade or economy that spoiled and enjoy the spoils of that colonial relation. In the rise of Europe, this is presented as this collusion between elites and kings or sovereigns for monopolistic profits, as a stance, a different stance vis-a-vis the Netherlands or England. There were fleets over the Atlantic, and a single ship over the Pacific that the Spanish freighted. For Spanish economic historians or historians of the period, this is a restricted trade because these monopolists have every intent and incentive to repress demand, so securely artificially high prices. So these two characteristics don't match. Either we have a reluctant monopolist or a very inefficient one, which is the conventional story. And this is interesting, I think, that it matters because it's the usual counterfactual for the European or the English model. Some facts. The Spanish trade was completely private. It was untaxed, unrecorded, and unaccounted because of the low state capacity of the Spanish state and empire. Moreover, it was done at the expense of the state or using state infrastructure, the case of the Manila Galleon. The prerogative, so the privilege to trade, was granted to locals in city, in port cities, yeah, and that privilege was managed by local guilds. There wasn't any national wide institutions, which, you know, cooperated or organized not for profit, but for jurisdiction. There were, in fact, a court. And they traded with the sovereign, with the king, jurisdiction for tax farming. Because this privilege was granted to the naturals or the locals or the vecinos, and it was a local discretion, naturalization of foreigners was feasible and very frequent. Companies existed much later on as a very late development and didn't have much success. Exceptions to these privileges were granted by the king, yeah, for a fee or for money, to anybody else, like the French that traded in the Pacific, or the Dutch in the Caribbean, the asientos from the South Sea Company to any Portuguese or Genoese that wanted to take slaves. That was the way that Spanish America financed their slave trade. And unlike the story or the history of the incorporated companies and the king or the sovereign in this country, there you have a competition, yeah, between guilds and kings. There was no charters, they were not negotiated whatsoever. Moreover, for the difference, the trade overseas that the Spanish enjoyed, either did or intermediated, was debt financed. You know, it was financed by debt. And that was by means of advancing capital or goods or money for that goods to be re-exported or sent further to America. And the sources were European, non-Spanish necessarily, and mostly in the 18th century, non-Spanish, merchant houses and mercantile capital. In the case of the Pacific, there was the Spears Fund, private money intermediated by the church or religious institutions, lent in Asia for goods back to America. This trade was not free trade, but it wasn't regulated either. There were exchanges in fairs in which this, like in the way of the medieval fairs, the different corporations of the different oligopolies would trade and exchange. And more interestingly, though, these transactions were spot sales on spot. Yeah, the exchanges, the good for silver or silver for good, were done on spot. That makes the importer of goods price takers. Yeah, and that's already the first qualification of the role of the demand of Spanish America. These transactions and these debts were cleared in full, yeah, at these fairs. And there were one-off venture. Every transaction was a new contract and didn't stop the recurrence of this trade because there were very high markups, but there was no scaling up either in the fleets on the Atlantic or the Pacific in the Galleon. The instrument this commerce use is a very known instrument that has different names, whether in Portugal, in Italy or France, or even in English, and they are all iterations of the same thing. It's a loan for the duration of the voyage, with a precise length of time after arrival for the clearance of the debt. In this case, there were additional provisions for interest in the case of, particularly for the return or delays or the prospect of any war. And the difference with the bill is that has the interest rate implicit. That is, there is an ex-ante determination of the payoff, which historians and economic historians justified because of the risk, and has taken most historians or economic historians to take this instrument as a mix of insurance and credit. It is more complicated than that. For others, it's a way to avoid usury laws, but you know that is something that probably disguises the real importance of this. Interestingly, the lender is forfeit in full, for the total investment if the losses are in full, and there is some sort of pro rata apportioning if losses are partial. It's something that in Latin would be, I won't be able to pronounce properly, but it's a permutatio in solidum in which there are no agents, no commissioners. It's a sort of equity loan. Yeah, but both parties are invested in the venture. These were all private transactions. There are about, you know, in the 25 public notaries in Cádiz, about 60,000 accounted or listed in the for the 18th century. There hasn't been just a sort of an exploration on the surface of this. Samples of about 30,000. Are available, but as a financial instrument, they were not negotiable, and distinguished this passive and active investor, the lenders or the borrowers, if you wish, originally the shipmasters, later on with the freighters or cargadores, outright merchants. The foreign houses participated of this financing. Sometimes they traded, and more later on in the 18th century, they financed the trade directly. And unlike the case of the joint stock companies, you have few investors, or few providers of capital, many, many borrowers or takers or active investors that take the goods to America or the goods to America, either from the Atlantic or the Pacific. There was no specialization in this financial market, as both are lenders and debtors, and there wasn't any concentration of note, because it's visible that the distribution of this instrument, of these loans, shows a few very large ventures and very, very many small ventures, including women and so on, that participated in this. The difference of this instrument with the bills of exchange, the dissociated credit and exchange, is that includes what is called die exchange in the pricing and distribution of this trade. The contract is priced in money of account in Spain, for instance, but is specifically directed to be paid off in X coin or money or metal, yeah, at destination. And there were huge differences between the money of account and the physical money. There were differences in Europe, and that is known in the development of the bills market and so on. But overseas, in the Atlantic to Europe, there was about 30% difference in the considering the purity, the content of fine silver in one and another place, and what was the standard in Spain vis-a-vis what was the actual coin in Spanish America. And, if you think of the Pacific, it's just, you know, whatever is the exchange rate of this coin as the demand for means of payment happens in China. So this contract includes the exchange rate together with the interest rate. So besides the time value of money, This contract includes any alteration of the monetary standards in place, yeah, debasement or any other change, and fluctuation in the gold-silver ratios that affects the terms of trade. Yeah, we cannot know the gain and losses from this using this instrument because the price is implicit and the contract pledges the return or the paying back X amount of money. But we should account for the secular demand for silver that comes from Asia throughout this period. Why there was no scaling in this contract with very high markups and so on? It's something that most economic historians overlook, and very few. I mean, one of the early global historians of Spanish America, Jeremy Vasquez, has shown this trade suffers from gluts, not from scarcity. And the response to gluts for this type of organization was rationing. And that's how they split the cargo in smaller ships, they split the investment among many freighters, they have different rates for each leg, they space out the fleet, they restrict the fleet to one galleon. That's the response to not scarcity, but to glut. Glutted markets in Spanish America is a recurrent feature in both coasts, the Pacific and the Atlantic. Nevertheless, this commerce has apparently very low rate of business failure. And the way that they dealt with it was with voluntary liquidation. There are two big waves of failure that apparently are now good guess. They are related with exogenous factor. One is the massive scamming potency adulteration of the currency in the mid of the 17th century that was felt elsewhere. And the other one is the impact of the French wars in the commerce over the Atlantic. The insurance as policy and as a non-institution everywhere else for this type of trade only happens in after the 1780s. And the reason for that low rate of failure is because there is a propensity or disposition to avoid taking recourse to legal and procedures. This consular court works as the arbiter, or in the case of Manila, there were just ad hoc court of vested parties to deal with this problem. And that solved the problem of commitment, in fact. From this mutual acceptance and systemic monitoring, which is very much what the banking system did in England before the Bank of England became the lender of last resort, that was the way to sort the commitment problem. So we have a very different situation where finance is available. The initial outlay for this commerce is ready, and the working capital not only is plenty, but rising throughout. I describe how was this done in Manila and Cadiz, but we have the case already that by the late, you know, third quarter of the 18th century, Spanish Americans are investing in Europe in this trade, or, you know, basically they are financing the trade over the Pacific. And it's not that the Spanish or the Spanish Americans did not know or did not use fiduciary instruments. They did. And they did it in their domestic trade. Yeah. How big this was, again, because there's no centralized record of any sort. These are fully private business. It's depend, you know, this information comes from, private archives and some litigation. But the trends somehow replicate what is the trend of the production and the coinage and the export of silver out of Spanish America. You would have to believe me or read other articles. Well, I want to, for credibility, but what I want to mention now is that this instrument was way more ubiquitous than we think. It was in Europe, in the European trade with America, was used by the Dutch, by the French, by the Genoese and the Irish. It was used by the suppliers of goods to the fleet. And in Asia, it was equally prevalent. Yeah. it was the means, I mean, the instrument of finance for the galleon was the way to finance any business outside the East India Company. It was used in pre-Dutch Indonesia, in 17th century Nagasaki, in Portuguese Macau was the source of revenues for the local council, and the Danish and the Swedish companies used this instrument in the intra-Asian trade. The British themselves did it, and we have this interesting case that the British East India Company gives respondential loans, but doesn't take it. So that's a question for the big practice, the idea of best practice, right? If this financial development that we associate with the European model was the best practice, and how universal this was. Just to prove the point, you have an excerpt from the correspondence of the council at St. George's, where precisely they explain how they use this instrument as a means to trade for metals, for silver mainly, or any other foreign money. And as the greatest historian of the European trading canton, Jay Minyi, has put it, it is the single way to do without pesos. It's a way to get pesos, particularly in Asia, with which to carry this trade on. So to conclude, we know well this European model, which is somehow what informs the literature and financial history and the and financial economics builds and all these sort of innovations and institutions that characterize Europe. That worked for Europe because silver was scarce there or was short. And there were institutions that could and did determine the exchange rate, that they fixed the exchange rate. That is the difference between the respondential loans of the East India Company with anybody else. The company fixes the exchange rate at which the money will be returned, and they have the capacity to do that. And so did the Bank of England and the Mint in England. Elsewhere, all these sort of archaic traditional instruments cannot be qualified like that. They were still adequate. And in fact, they were not exclusive, but supplementary, bills and respondentia, particularly in the trades that demanded non-fiduciary money. I am not talking here about commodity money. I am talking about silver money. So in thinking, the role of institutions and the possibility of reciprocal comparison, I think that we have to go back to the different conditions, namely endowment, and the appropriateness of the institutions for the specifics of trade in each case, to deal with scarcity or with the lack of, as it was in the case of Spanish America. To think back on the necessary and sufficient conditions that we use on the explanations, and probably look back at the counterfactual of the European financial development, maybe. I have a suggestion or an idea I'm trying to develop. But all in all, it's somehow to go back to the universality or the explanatory power of the institutions that we are dealing with as today. It's more than a minute. But I did my best.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.